stood tall on the hill above Rough Valley Forest. The Bishoptown village lay nestled in the valley of Three Hills, but the boundary reached up to both the hill where Josie and Hugh Barrett lived and the larger hill where the Duke of Hardwick resided in his stately home. Between the Barrett House and Wetherington House, part of Rough Valley Forest snaked through the valleys. Looking at it made my chest tighten. Had Aidan been held captive inside the woods, or had he staggered through part of the woods from somewhere else? No one knew how long he'd been walking. No one knew where he had come from. My phone rang. I swiped the bar across, recognizing the number. Hi, what's up? They took my fucking picture. Who took your picture, Rob? The fucking reporters, who the fuck else? Oh, calm down. I'm at Josie's place. Come up here. I'm hiding from the reporters. They're all camped outside my house. I'm on my way. Less than 10 minutes later, a disheveled Rob turned up at the door, red-faced and fuming. He ran his hands through his wet hair and brushed past me as he hurried into the house. I can't believe it. The bastard. He shoved that thing right in my face and I nearly lost it. Josie popped her head round the door of the kitchen. I'll put the kettle on, Rob. He didn't even notice. Instead, he paced the length of the entrance hall. Where's Aidan? He's in the living room watching The Jungle Book. Listen, Rob, there's something I need to tell you about this morning. I hesitated. I didn't want to tell him, not like this. But if I left it much longer, it would get worse. What? Did the bastards get you too? Rob had a wild way about him when he was agitated. He fidgeted like a junkie in need of a fix. He scratched his forearms and rubbed his bulging eyes, as if he had more energy than he could handle, but felt exhausted at the same time. No, nothing like that. It's about me and Aidan. I did something really stupid. He stopped pacing the hallway and moved closer to me instead. I noticed how his hands moved up like he was contemplating reaching out to me, but then his arms dropped by his side. What is it? It can't be that bad. You never do anything stupid, Em. I bet it wasn't as stupid as getting your mug photographed by some scummy paparazzi. I shook my head and backed away. It's worse. Anyone for a cuppa? Josie called, saving me from blurting everything out. Coming! Called. Come and sit down for a minute. You'll feel better. I want to know what's going on. I chewed on my bottom lip and scratched at a patch of dry skin on my hand. The anxieties of the last few days were catching up with me. I was changing in a physical sense. The lack of sleep, the constant worry, and the fact that I was so busy in the late stages of my pregnancy had brought nothing but dry skin and circles under my eyes. I'd even lost a little weight. Long time no see, Hartley. Josie placed a mug of steaming tea onto the breakfast bar as we moved into the kitchen. Are those grey hairs I see? And crow's feet just there? She pointed at his eyes. Rob swatted Josie's hand away, but failed to hide his smile. Yeah, and that's new moustache hair, isn't it? Cheeky arsehole. Josie rolled her eyes exaggeratedly when she turned to me. I mouthed a thank you for helping calm him down. But even still, when I swallowed, my throat was dry. I was dreading telling him about the incident in the forest. They're going to think I did it, aren't they? Rob let out a long, slow, depressed sigh. They're going to think I somehow did this to my own son. That's what they always think. How could they? You've been in the army. You've got the strongest possible alibi there is, I said. I had no idea he'd been worrying about this. I know that, but they don't know it yet. They'll think I've been sneaking out or something, or that I have some sick accomplice. They always think it's the dad. He sipped on his tea. Fuck all this. I don't want to think about it anymore. What did you have to tell me? Is it worse? Is it better? Have they caught the monster? No, it's not better or worse, really. I set down my tea and told Rob about taking Aidan into the woods. Though I didn't look at him directly, I was aware of his weight shifting as he fidgeted on the stool, aware of his back straightening in my peripheral vision. There was silence when I finished talking. I lost control. Placed my head in my hands. It's all right, Em, Josie soothed. No, it's not. Rob set his mug down with an audible bang. Why didn't you tell me you were going to do this? Why didn't you phone me? You know what a fucking phone is, Emma, right? Keep your voice down. Aiden is in the next room and the last thing he needs is to hear you ranting and swearing, I said. Yeah, I know that, but I'm mad, aren't I? I'm fuming because you took our son to do a bloody reconstruction of the day he staggered out of his 10-year captivity. Everything moved so fast, they wanted to keep it as small as possible. They suggested I go by myself. I knew you'd refuse to stay away if I told you about it. Oh, you knew, did you? That's a pretty trick. Reading someone's mind. You have to show it to me one day. I shook my head. Even after all this time, he was still just as infuriating as ever. Grow up, Rob! Guys, Josie intervened. Remember what's important. The kid in the other room watching a DVD. He's all that matters. Exactly, Rob said. And that's why what you did was wrong, Emma. Don't you see that? I knew when he got to his feet that I'd made a huge mistake choosing this particular moment to tell Rob about the events of the morning. He was too wired, too agitated. He was on the edge. I should have seen that. I'm sorry. He'd stopped listening to me. I think I should take him home with me. It's the best way. You're a mess, Emma. You're making terrible decisions. You tried to drag Aiden into the woods. For fuck's sake! The reporters are outside your house. It makes sense. It was my turn to get to my feet. Absolutely not! I'm not giving up so easily. He's my son. He's coming home. And he's not mine. Rob's eyes were wide and pleading. Little boy's eyes. His presence was an intimidating one in the Barrett's kitchen, but there was something of the child in him too. He'd always had an air of vulnerability about him. That's not what I meant. I'm his mother. And there it is. That's what it all boils down to, the mother. I remember the first shit show that came out in the press 10 years ago. How every picture was all about you. The poor, distraught mother. Fathers aren't allowed to grieve, are they? Not in the same way. They aren't given the luxury of breaking down like a mother is. Mothers get all the rights and are still allowed to fuck up as much as they want. That's not fair, Rob, Josie said. I rubbed my hands anxiously, desperately trying to rub away the things that had happened that morning. He was right, in a way. It was expected for the mother to break down. Perhaps I had been allowed to grieve too much and for too long after Aiden's disappearance. But this time I couldn't. There was no way I could lose control like that again. I opened my mouth to rebuke his argument, but lost my train of thought when a strange high-pitched sound came from the living room. I was vaguely aware of my facial muscles slackening as I hopped down from the stool and hurried out of the kitchen. Rob only stared after me with a question on his lips as I rushed through the kitchen door, colliding against the doorframe with my hip as my socks slipped on the wooden floorboards. By the time I reached the living room, I was out of breath and panting. Aiden was sat exactly where we had left him, watching a different DVD this time. The Aristocats, with the sound on mute. He turned to me as I entered the room, but he didn't say a word. He didn't make a sound. Footsteps sounded behind me and Rob entered the room. What is it? I thought I heard him singing. Chapter 16. 3 hours later, I called Jake and told him I was coming home. Josie had kindly made us a few sandwiches and a couple more coppers, though we'd all fancied a vodka and coke after the day we'd had. Rob settled down with us and watched another Disney DVD before we agreed to keep going as we already were, with Aiden living at my house, but communicate with each other every step of the way. We were in the midst of a journey, for better or worse, and that journey was likely to be arduous. We needed each other. And I needed Jake, in my own way. I'd already thought of 50 things I wanted to tell him and plenty of issues I wanted his opinion about. Whether to enlist help with PR was one thing. None of us were experts when it came to the press. God knows I'd failed the first time this happened. I shuddered as I thought about the headlines from the tabloids. Rob had remembered it one way, but I recollected that time differently. Teen mum let little Aiden go. Young mum drinking heavily night before flood. They'd raided my MySpace and Facebook pages, pulling every picture of me out with my friends. What they didn't show was Aiden tucked up in bed with his grandparents downstairs. They didn't show the pictures of me taking Aiden to get his vaccinations or breastfeeding in the early hours of the morning. No, I was a young mum, a teen mum, even though I was 24 at the time of Aiden's disappearance. Being young equated to being bad. That was what they really wanted to say. I was a bad mother, and it was all my fault that he wandered away from school. And poor Amy Perry wasn't let off the hook either. They even found a picture of us both out at a local pub with pint glasses in our hands. We were the boozy mum and teacher, living at large while a kid drowned in the river. That was what they meant. That was what they implied. Yes, I could lose it from grief. I could break down in a way Rob couldn't, but I had been persecuted for not shutting my legs when I was a teenager, and I was dragged over hot coals for having a social life while my son was a toddler. I hated them. I hated them almost as much as I hated the man who took Aiden from me all those years ago. I hated them as I pulled into my street and still saw the occasional van on our road, even though I'd waited until after the sun went down to try and sneak into the house. I held my breath as I pulled into the driveway. My heart was racing and my hand trembled as I undid my seatbelt. Just stay with me, Aiden, okay? Stay close to me. I was far more agitated than he was. He didn't need any more prompting to stay calm. The events of the morning seemed to have faded away and he was at least a little more relaxed than he had been. The look of terror on his face as we stood by Rough Valley would haunt me for the rest of my life. I took a deep breath and opened the car door, crunching gravel beneath my feet. Mrs. Price here, it's Simon Garry from the News of the World. Would you be interested in telling Aiden's story? No, thank you. I hurried around the car, avoiding the gaze of the short, bald man following me. Where's Aiden been all this time? I kept my mouth firmly closed as I opened Aiden's door and took his hand. At least there didn't seem to be a photographer there yet. What's happened to him? Where did he go? I think you should leave. This is private property. I fumbled in my handbag for my keys, almost spilling the contents onto the ground. Before I could get the key in the lock, the door was snatched open and Jake ushered us both into the house. I wrapped my arms around his neck and held him tight. Thank you. I've got you, he murmured into my hair. His voice always carried a hint of the South in his husky moments. I've got you now. He led me through to the kitchen and sat me down. Aiden, why don't you pour your mum a glass of water? Jake moved his head in the direction of the correct cupboard. I noticed that even the kitchen curtains were closed, which we never usually bothered to do. The kitchen faced a private back garden almost completely secluded by a line of tall fir trees. Aiden moved quietly around the room, picking a glass out of the cupboard and pouring tap water into it. He placed it carefully on the table in front of me. Good lad. Now why don't you go upstairs for a bit? I left you some books on your bedside table so you can read. Jake smiled at Aiden as he gave him instructions. He was in teacher mode and something in Aiden was responding to it. Aiden followed his directions almost robotically. I watched him with interest as he stepped out of the room. What is it? Jake asked. It's probably nothing. Jake tilted his head to one side and gave me a questioning look. It's just the way Aiden responds to your direction. There's something weird about it. Jake let out a small laugh. What are you talking about? He does the same for you. No, it's not the same. There's something different about the way he acts around you. I shrugged and sipped my water. Maybe it's nothing. I'm being silly. You're not. You're being a mother. Jake stepped around the table and rubbed the small of my back. Maybe it's hard for you to see a man around Aiden after what's happened to him. You're just going into protective mode. But I wasn't sure that was true. I never noticed a change in Aiden's behaviour when he was around Rob. How's Bump today? I pulled myself out of my thoughts to answer. She's fine. You look tired out, Emma Hewitt. On the sofa with you. I think a foot rub is in order. That does sound good. What about Aiden? He needs some space, Em. Let him be. Jake took my hand and led me through the kitchen into the living room. It didn't even occur to me until much later that he called me Em for the very first time. We became our own little world in the days that followed. We turned off the television, we ignored the newspapers. We put our phones on silent. Only Jake was brave enough to leave the house, fetching us food from the suggestions Dr. Schaefer gave me. But I added comfort food. Chocolate, ice cream, white bread. I couldn't help myself. We shut the curtains and unplugged the landline from the wall. Our family liaison officers would come for meetings and ask us questions that didn't seem relevant. Questions about our daily routine. After the questions stopped, they tended to hover awkwardly around us during the daytime. For the most part, they were useless, seeing as the police hadn't found anything. The only people I had telephone conversations with were Rob and a far too cheerful woman from a PR company who offered to help us write a statement to the press. I decided that the generic "please respect our privacy at this difficult time" would be enough. And when it came to offers of appearing on television, I decided silence was the best option. I couldn't stand the thought of an interview appearing on YouTube after doing its rounds on the news, free to be judged by the hordes of people following Aidan's case. Instead, after speaking to DCI Stevenson, it was agreed that he would issue a statement appealing to any witnesses from the night Aidan was found wandering along the back road. "We're extending the search," he said. "We started looking into houses in the area with large basements, as well as anyone who might have put in planning applications for unusual builds a decade ago. It's going to take some time." This was the countryside. There were plenty of wealthy families with extensions, outbuildings and cellars. "How is Aidan?" he asked. There was an edge in his voice. We both knew it was there, but neither of us acknowledged it. "He's not talking yet," I replied. After hanging up the telephone, I closed my eyes and tried to wish it all away. For a while, I almost did. None of it mattered, because we were on an island in the middle of the Indian Ocean. We were off the coast of Australia, and every morning I greeted Aidan with a "G'day, mate." Then we'd spread out the picnic blanket, put Netflix on, and pretend we were sat on the top of the tallest mountain with the world below us. I chose some of my favourite films that I'd always wanted to watch with Aidan, but had been waiting for him to get a little older before we did. The Neverending Story, Bugsy Malone, The Goonies. More than once I almost turned off those innocuous films when any character was in peril. I reached out for the remote with my heart racing, but Aidan never reacted. He sat, and he chewed his food, and he didn't say a word. "You can't do this forever," Jake said from the sofa. He had an art history textbook in his hand and his glasses pushed high up his nose. "I know." I pushed the ice cream around the bowl. "Okay, time for a game of basketball." It was something we played when Aidan was little. I used to take pieces of paper, screw them up, and play at throwing them through a hoop I'd made out of a wire coat hanger. In fact, all of the games were rehashed versions of what we had done when Aidan was a toddler, like the indoor picnics, which inevitably occurred in fictional versions of the Great Wall of China, or Kilimanjaro, or Cairo, or anywhere but Bishoptown on Ouse. It had been the only way to curb my wanderlust when I was a teenage mum without the same prospects as my friends. "He's not going to want to play basketball." Jake uncrossed his legs and stared down at us. "Look at him. What else am I going to do? For one thing, I don't think it's good for you to be on the floor on that scabby picnic blanket when you're 8 months pregnant. For another, you've eaten nothing but ice cream for 2 days. That's not taking care of the baby. Get up, stop messing around, and face what's going on." My cheeks flushed with heat. He thought I wasn't accepting the grim reality of the situation, but he was wrong. I knew exactly what was happening. I was trying to shield Aidan from it. He wasn't ready. How could anyone be ready for what was going to happen? If I, a fully grown woman, wasn't ready, how could my damaged, vulnerable son get through the ordeal? "Basketball," I said. Clambered ungracefully to my feet, walked into Jake's study and took a few sheets of paper from the desk. When I got back into the living room, Jake was on his knees talking to Aidan. "What's going on?" "We're just having a chinwag." Jake grinned and patted Aidan on the shoulder. "I was telling him that it might be a good idea for him to spend some time with his dad and grandparents." I dropped the paper. "What? Why? How dare you say that to Aidan without suggesting it to me first?" He shrugged. "What's the problem? He hasn't seen them for days. It isn't fair you keeping him cooped up in here. I'm protecting him. I've told Rob, Sonia and Peter not to come. You know what Rob's temper's like. The last thing we need is him yelling at the press and making the scene. I know Sonia is itching to help, but what can she do? No. Aiden needs some space from the circus. He needs time with just us so that he can adjust. Wherever he was probably alone for a long time. Too many people will just freak him out. He needs time away from this house. More like you just want him out of here. I muttered under my breath. Jake got to his feet. What was that? I backed out of the room, then turned and walked into the kitchen, shaking my head at the ridiculousness of the argument. Look, I know you've been trying to make the most of things, but it's so obvious that you don't want Aiden around. You going up to him and basically telling him to get out doesn't help. Emma, I don't know how I can make myself any clearer. I don't want Aiden out of my house. I just want him to get some fresh air, to see people other than me or you, and to actually begin to face his own reality. It isn't doing him any good being here with us. He's improving, I insisted. I can tell he's listening to me. He's taking everything in. You're seeing something that isn't there. Trust me. I have some perspective on this. He's not improving. He's a vegetable, Emma. He sits there without even the slightest remnant of human emotion on his face. The other day I walked out of the bathroom and he was stood in the corridor doing nothing, just standing, staring. I rubbed the dry skin on my hands and paced up and down the kitchen. Vegetable! What the fuck, Jake? How could you? He removed his glasses and pinched the bridge of his nose. That came out wrong. But it was too late. His harsh words had a cruel edge, but that didn't mask the truth of them. When I spoke, there was a new quaver of uncertainty in my voice. He's not a vegetable, is he? He's aware, isn't he? Jake moved forward, took me by the shoulders and stared deep into my eyes. Emma, he is psychologically damaged. No matter how much you want to, you can't do this on your own. Chapter 17. The decor in Dr. Foster's office was designed to convey a bright cheerfulness that verged on the contrived. It was the kind of room I would have hated as a teenager. I sat on a bright red sofa and stared at the abstract painting hung on the wall on the other side of the room. Large, sweeping brushstrokes whirled together every shade of yellow known to the imagination. The carpet was patterned in interconnecting loops of the primary colours like an 80s lunchbox design. It was Thursday by the time I dragged us out of our withdrawal from the world, and the two of us emerged like bears from hibernation, rubbing our eyes and squinting at the sun. I spent the journey to the surgery trying to stop my hands from trembling as they gripped the steering wheel and avoiding eye contact with the people around me. But it was important for Aiden to see a therapist. He'd had a difficult adjustment to life outside hospital, and now I knew it was time to listen to Jake. Luckily, Dr. Foster was prepared to see Aiden even before his status as deceased had been repealed. When the door opened, it scraped across the wooden floorboards, making a high-pitched squeaking sound. Aiden let out a sudden gasp and sat up very straight. His face paled in a way I hadn't seen since we tried to force him into the woods. I placed my hand on his, moving very slowly, as I always did when I touched him. "Hello again, Emma. Good morning, Aiden." Dr. Foster was as cheerful as her waiting room, but she had a natural quality about her that was less contrived. Her image belonged on a box of organic muesli. She was very natural and easy, a people person. "Would you like to come in?" Aiden followed my lead into Dr. Foster's office. After Aiden's disappearance during the flood, I'd spent some time in therapy at a place in York. That had been what I would consider a typical therapist's office to be like. It was very sparse, with comfortable chairs, a bookcase, and a large wooden desk. This was the opposite. It was filled with colour, from the baskets of toys to the artwork on the walls to a couple of bouquets of fresh flowers on the windowsill. "Take a seat, wherever is comfortable." I eyed the beanbag chair but decided I would never get out of it if I sat down. So I chose a plastic upright chair and pulled one across for Aiden. I'm so glad you decided to come and see me. I think it will be really useful for Aiden's progression. I didn't know what to say, so I just nodded. It wasn't that I disagreed with her. I was glad we were going to therapy, but it had been an ordeal to get to the office. I had to throw a blanket over Aiden's head to try to keep the paparazzi from taking any photographs of him. I couldn't bear for anyone to print his photograph without my consent. It's lovely to see you again, Aiden. I see you've had your hair cut. Well, it was me with some blunt scissors over the bathroom sink, I said with a laugh that felt unnatural. It's not the best haircut in the world. No, well, I think you look very fetching. A touch of Yorkshire in her voice helped to calm my nerves. It was like an old friend. Bishoptown residents tended to have slightly posher voices. There were some strong Yorkshire accents, but more often than not, I heard BBC English around the village. I smiled at Aiden. I think he likes it. I don't think he can tell me for a while, but I like to think that if he could, he would. There was the smallest hint of a crack in Dr. Foster's smile, and I wasn't sure I liked the way she regarded me then, with a slow nod of her head. Absolutely. So today, Aiden, I would like you to draw me some more pictures. Would you like that? Excellent. She glossed quickly over Aiden's lack of response. How about I set you up on the desk over there? There are some coloured pencils and plenty of paper. Draw whatever pops into your head. That's it? Very good. Once Aiden was set up, Dr. Foster came across to sit with me. Sorry if it seems like I'm talking down to him, but I think it's best to go gently with him for a while. I do the same. He doesn't seem like a 16-year-old boy. I thought of the kids at school, so cocksure and loud, full of themselves and full of the belief that they ruled the world. No, but that will come in time, she said. What can you tell me about his progress? He hasn't said anything, not a thing, but... Go on, she prompted. I think I heard him sing. When Dr. Foster leaned forward, I didn't like the little glint of excitement in her eyes. I suddenly imagined I could see pound signs dancing around in her imagination for when she submitted an article entitled The Feral Child of Yorkshire. Really? What led up to this development? I pushed my hands between my thighs to stop myself rubbing the dry patches of skin, which were now red and angry from my constant niggling. There was an argument. I glanced up, expecting to see disapproval in Dr. Foster's expression. I'm not here to judge. Your family has been put into an extremely stressful situation over the last week. Arguments are to be expected. Aiden was in the other room. It was the day we met at the woods. I was not in a good place. I tried to go home and the reporters were there, so I went to my best friend's house. Rob came to meet us. He was agitated. Some reporter had taken his picture and he was obsessed with the idea that they'd accuse him of kidnap. They always go after the dads, he said. I told him about the thing with the police and he lost his temper. In a violent way? No, just raised voices. Then there was a slight pause and I heard this high-pitched singing coming from the living room. I think it was Aiden. We'd left him in there watching Disney films. You're sure it was Aiden? It couldn't have been the film. I shrugged. Didn't sound like anything from the film. He had the sound muted when I walked in. Did you recognize the words or the tune from what Aiden was singing? I shook my head. I didn't hear words, just a small voice. It was kind of haunting. You know those creepy songs they use in horror films when a child is possessed by a ghost or a doll comes to life. A half smile spread across her lips. My husband watches those films, so yes. It was a little bit like that, like a nursery rhyme. I shivered. I hadn't thought much about the song since we'd come back from Josie's. I'd had the reporters to deal with, and then I had tried to block out the world. Maybe I tried too hard. Maybe Jake was right. And since that morning? She prompted. I shook my head. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Barely a whimper. On the day you heard the singing, did anyone else hear his voice? No, actually, it was just me. Do you think I imagined it? No, she said with a voice that suggested that perhaps she did. Well, not necessarily, but we can't rule it out as an explanation. Now, tell me about how Aiden is sleeping since he came home from the hospital. He goes to bed at 8 p.m. every night, and I check on him at 9 p.m. He's always laid with his eyes shut, but I'm not sure if he's asleep or not. Sometimes I think he's pretending. What makes you think that? Just the way he lies on his back with his arms on either side, it doesn't look comfortable. Sometimes when I check on him later in the night, he'll have rolled onto his side, and that seems more normal. Any night terrors? He sleeps with the door open, always. I've never closed the door to a room he's in. I think that might help him, because he's been sleeping well since he came home. There was one time I saw him tossing and turning. I didn't want to wake him up properly, because I know he doesn't like to be touched too much. After about 30 seconds, he drifted into a deeper sleep and seemed fine. Dr. Foster tapped her pen on top of her open notebook. That's a very good sign. He's getting rest. He's clearly putting on some weight. These are all good things, Mrs. Price Hewitt. You're doing just fine. You'd say that even after what you saw the other day in the woods. I let out a hollow laugh. Yes, I would. You're only human, Emma. Try not to beat yourself up about the incident in the forest. Everyone was under intense stress. It was a little too soon for Aiden, that's all. She leaned back in her chair. Now, tell me how you're doing. Would you like me to refer you to a therapist? You've been through an extraordinary event. Talking about it might help. No, thank you. I had some therapy. After I thought Aiden had drowned, it helped in some ways, but not in others. I'm okay. I thought Aiden had died. I've already been through the worst pain a human being can deal with. Everything that comes after that pales in significance. I'm going to be fine. There's a big difference between being fine and being well, Emma. Dr. Foster leaned her chin on her fist and spoke softly. Everyone wants you to be well, happy and healthy. Just remember that. Especially Aiden. She got to her feet with a groan, rubbing her knees. These old bones. The cold sets in these days. Just you wait. She winked at me. And how are we getting on over here, Aiden? What have you drawn for me? Aiden lifted his picture and I broke out into a smile. Just the fact that my son had held up his own artwork was enough to make me feel joy. But Dr. Foster wasn't smiling at all. I got up from my seat, cradling my belly, and made my way over to the other side of the room. It was there that I saw what Aiden had drawn. Like his first piece of art, there was no shape, only chaos. This time he'd chosen two red crayons to complete his piece. The red crayon lines spread from one side of the page to the other, like his first drawing in the hospital. But there was one difference to this piece. In the center of the picture, Aiden had drawn a set of white, sharp teeth. They were open wide, ready to chomp down on their prey. My first instinct was to snatch the drawing out of his hands, screw it up and throw it away. But I didn't. I nodded, and I smiled. All the time, I felt as though ants were crawling over my skin. Chapter 18. I left Aiden's distressing art with Dr. Foster, uneasy about letting anything that sinister into my home. But as she informed me on the way out of her office, Aiden needed some way to express himself. While he was unable to do so verbally, he needed another outlet. Drawing would be excellent therapy for him. Back in the car, before we set off, I leaned against the steering wheel to compose myself. I knew what I had to do, but I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. Okay, Aiden, let's get you home. We managed to avoid the reporters on our way into the house, and after we'd had a lunch of ham salad sandwiches, I was taking Jake's advice about eating healthily. I sucked in a deep breath and opened the garage door. There was a reason why our car was always parked outside the house on the drive. It wasn't that we didn't use the garage, it was that the car wouldn't fit. Rob was right about the house being absent of colour, and That was because all the colour had been left in the garage. This was where we created. This was our artistic home. I flicked on the switch and it all came to life. It's okay, Aiden. You can come in. It's all safe. I wanted to open the front of the garage to let in the sunlight, but I was all too aware of the reporters still hanging around our house. We had to make do with the light from the kitchen doorway. I want to show you something. The walls were lined with canvases. Most of the paintings were mine, created after the flood and spanning up to a few years ago when I finally let go and accepted Aiden's death. After a deep breath, I held Aiden's hand and walked him around the garage. It was strange to hold his hand now. It was so much bigger than the hand I'd held 10 years ago. Though he appeared so much younger than the young men at school, I had to remember that he was a teenager now. He was almost an adult. "This is you and me," I said, pointing to a portrait of a young girl with big eyes holding a tiny baby in her arms. "I was scared when you arrived, but I loved you so much that it didn't matter. This is you in your Superman cape." I grinned. I painted it from memory 6 months after Aiden's disappearance. There was something painful in the reds and the aggressive brushstrokes, but I'd captured Aiden's cheeky face perfectly. Then I moved on to another portrait, and the smile faded. This is a difficult one. I was in a bad place back then. I missed you so much that I didn't know what to do with myself. I felt useless. It was a zoomed-in portrait of my own face. I was snarling. My eyes were sunken. My skin was red and patchy. There were dark, bruised marks above my cheekbones. This was from the year after the flood. I was angry. I squeezed Aiden's hand and moved on. At least he was getting used to me touching him. Slow steps. The next series of paintings were all the same. "You see these?" pointed to each one in turn. "These are the birthday cakes I made you every year. I never forgot. The 3rd of April. This was the first year. I made you a Super Bat Iron Man cake. See?" He had a cape, an iron suit, and bat ears. You would have loved it. It was sunny that year. Then this one was a winged Ferrari. You always said you wanted a fine car for every birthday. Then I made you a dragon cake, just like walnut. It was a walnut cake, too, with vanilla buttercream. I cleared my throat, forcing away the emotion. Do you see what I was trying to do? I painted my feelings out. That was what I did when I lost you. I painted all of these. My eyes trailed along the wall of paintings, reaching the very last one. The one that had been torn all down one side. I didn't look at that one for very long. It's okay. If you want to paint out your feelings too, I'm going to set up a canvas for you. There are some paints here. I want you to paint like you used to when you were little. I moved an easel into the centre of the garage and lowered it to Aiden's height, then pulled across a small table to set beside it and put a chair in front. Then I brought in jam jars of water and arranged all the paints and paintbrushes next to the water. Part of me itched to join him, and I wondered whether it would help him start to see someone else working with him. But in the end, I decided this was all about Aiden. He deserved to be left alone. So once I had set him up, I went into the kitchen to make a cup of tea. When I leaned my head around the door into the garage, Aiden was sat leaning over the canvas, moving his paintbrush in an arc. I smiled and took a sip of my tea. There were times I believed Aiden almost wanted to talk to me, and after he finished his painting was one of them. He walked up to the kitchen door and stood there in the space where the kitchen and garage connected. "Have you finished?" I asked. This time I waited. I sensed that he wanted to speak. He wanted to tell me that he was done. He was proud, I realized. Instead, all I got was the slightest of nods, almost imperceptible. That was enough to get my heart soaring. Progress at last. I followed him into the garage where he proudly displayed another terrifying piece of art, and I tried my best not to seem horrified by it. This time he'd painted in blues and greens. They'd been mixed together into a spiral which narrowed into a dark point in the center. It reminded me of the tunnels in my nightmares. "It's beautiful, sweetheart," I said. Later that afternoon, while Jake was still at school, he'd taken time off for the first few days as we dealt with the issues with the reporters, but I could tell he was itching to go back, so I let him. I took Aiden to see his dad and grandma, not just to get Aiden out of the house, but also to get away from Denise, who came to our house every day with a forced smile that made me itch. In the living room of the B&B, Rob spread the newspapers across the table. Aiden was listening to Sonia read him The Hobbit. "Look at what those scum have been saying," Rob indicated the newspapers. "I don't really want to, Rob. I've been trying to keep all this away from Aiden, to be honest. I don't think it'll do him any good." Bump kicked on my bladder and I shifted my weight, stroking the top of my stomach. "I'm not going to show him, Em. What kind of bloke do you think I am?" "Okay, well, he's only in the other room." Rob fixed me with his intense brown eyes. "I'm aware. I just wanted to show you." I got it. Rob was a talker. When something bothered him, he needed to talk about it. He needed to share the burden with another person. I was always the opposite. I kept things buried inside until they threatened to burst out of me. I tried not to think about the time I'd allowed everything to erupt out of me. It had only happened once in my life, and it hadn't been a pretty sight. "Look, there's that photo of me. Ex-officer Robert Hartley, they're calling me. I'm not an ex-officer. They want to make it sound like I've lost my job. Well, you're some sort of saint this time around. They all feel sorry for you." "I don't care, Rob. And look at this, they've even printed a copy of the thing Aiden drew in the hospital." I snatched the newspaper from his hand. "What? How did they get that?" "Probably one of those nurses. I bet they've sold it for hundreds. People will do anything to earn a quick buck, won't they? God, I need a drink. They think he's a nutter. They're calling our son a nutter. And have you seen what they're writing about Jake?" Even though I was still staring at the full page print of Aiden's disturbing artwork from the hospital, I still noticed the slight change in Rob's tone. It was quieter, less agitated. Made me wonder if this was what he had wanted to show me all along. "What are they writing about Jake?" Rob licked his finger and flicked through the newspaper to find the right page. The first thing I saw was a photograph of Jake when he was younger, with an arm around an even younger girl's shoulder. "Who is that?" I whispered, trying my hardest to keep the tremulous note from my voice, but failing miserably. "One of his students, apparently. They say he left his job in Bournemouth rather abruptly after their head teacher found out he chatted with several of the students on MSN Messenger and emailed them too. They say they became Facebook friends." The blood drained from my face. I closed the newspaper, not wanting to look at the picture any longer. I felt lightheaded. Jake didn't talk about his time in Bournemouth very often. In fact, he didn't talk about his life outside of Bishoptown hardly at all. I knew he'd studied his PGCE in Bournemouth, and I knew he had worked at a school there, but that was about it. His family were from that part of the country too, but his parents had only visited us one Christmas, and I hadn't thought much of it. Though I had to admit they seemed like odd people. They rolled up in their Land Rover dressed in the kind of attire that was more suited to a spot of pheasant shooting up in Wetherington House. But even though they were dressed in Wellington boots and barber jackets, each item of clothing was pristine, as if it were brand new. Even the Land Rover was gleaming. Jake's mother, Christine, had brought her own port to drink with the meal and not offered a drop to anyone else. She'd also pushed her turkey to the edge of her plate and asked if there was any goose as an alternative. Jake's father barely spoke all evening, except when he offered Jake a brandy in the lounge while the ladies tidied away the plates. Christine had then asked whether I'd made the trifle for dessert or bought it from Tesco or one of those places, as if she didn't even know what a supermarket was. I'd known that Jake's parents were rich, but I hadn't expected them to be quite so snooty. Just like I'd known about Jake's background in Bournemouth, but hadn't known anything about why he had decided to move so far north. I'd always thought that it was just that the opportunity arose, but it seemed odd that he'd moved quite so far away from home. Was he running from something? What else didn't I know about my husband? You didn't know, did you? Rob said. He never mentioned any of this. Of course I knew, I snapped. It's all a load of rubbish. But Rob's eyes narrowed. What else has he lied to you about? I shook my head. Nothing. He's not a liar, not like you. Rob's cheeks flushed. Don't bring that up, not now. I think it's time to take Aiden home. You can stop by and visit him whenever you like. I tucked the newspaper under my arm and waved through the door to the lounge for Aiden to leave. Are you sure, Em? Rob moved towards the front door of the kitchen. We were in the private area of the B&B behind reception. We've got to go. Em, listen to me. Just hear me out. If you notice anything weird about him, you have to say something. I know you'll dismiss this as jealousy or whatever, but it isn't. I don't trust that man, Emma. I never have. Chapter 19. I stopped at the Sainsbury's on the way back from Rob's and bought every newspaper I could find, avoiding familiar faces as I hurried from aisle to check out. But as I ducked down and hurried out of the shop, I couldn't resist looking back to see if any of the people milling around were talking about me. I spotted two people I knew. Carol, a barmaid at the Queen's Head, whispering to Barbara, who lived on the hill down from the school. There they were, whispering behind cupped hands, nodding in my direction. I fumbled with my car keys, remembering the exact same thing happening after the flood. It was all the same. The desperate rushes away from the shops, almost dropping my car keys or my house keys while trying to keep away from the whispering masses, the pitying looks. That was why I ignored every phone call from my colleagues at work. I'd listened to all the voicemails. Their bunch of flowers was still in its cellophane, dumped into a vase by Jake. I hadn't thought to arrange it. Since the story had broken, we'd received a multitude of cards and presents, but I couldn't deal with any of them. Instead, I asked Denise to take care of it, which suited me since it gave her a job to do that kept her from under my feet. She was the one who opened the cards and placed the ones that wished us well on the mantelpiece and the crazy ones filled with death threats and other nastiness in the recycling. She was the one who stood by the bins before the bin men arrived to stop the press going through our rubbish to find a new angle to their story. That much I was grateful for. It allowed me to ignore it as much as I could. But that was how I coped. I blocked the outside world away. When the flood hit Bishoptown and I thought Aiden had drowned, I'd learned that I couldn't trust anyone. I lost friends over it. I'd mention a tiny detail to someone and the next day it had been in the newspapers. It was better that I didn't talk to anyone except immediate family. There was no way of knowing who would go to the media and sell our secrets. I pulled into the drive and let Aiden out of the car. His steps were lighter since those precious moments of painting. Even the stiffness in his gait was improving. Though he still didn't talk to me, I got the sense that he was starting to relax around me, which was real progress after what had happened with the police. When he walked, his shoulders were down instead of hunched up. He was loosening up. He seemed taller, too, even though it had been barely a week since I'd first found out he was still alive. And though there was little change in his demeanour, I had a feeling that he was beginning to relax around me, or maybe I was beginning to relax around him. I waved to Denise, who was standing patiently outside the house, for me to let her in. "Thought we could have a catch-up," she said. "Sure," I replied. "Any news from the police station?" "No," she answered in what I felt was a clipped, sharp tone. Perhaps she was getting fed up of that question, or at least fed up of having to relay the same response. After the bustle of Rob's B&B, my house was quiet and still, so silent that when the floorboards creaked, I flinched. I took Aiden's coat and hung it on the rack, shutting out the chill from the October wind. I had the newspapers tucked under one arm and my handbag looped over the other. Once in the kitchen, I spread all the newspapers out over the table and opened them. Denise pulled a stuffed bear out of her bag. "Do you want to keep this, Teddy?" she asked. It came in with a bunch of fan mail. What do you reckon, Aidan? I glanced at my son, but he didn't react to the stuffed bear with the glass eyes. It was a sweet toy, but far too young for him now that he'd grown up. Charity bag, I said. Got ya, Denise replied. Where's Marcus today? He's working at the station today. We felt you didn't need both of us around all the time anymore. Ah, I see. Aidan, why don't you go and watch some TV with Denise for a while? I shifted my gaze to Denise. Unless there was something else she wanted to talk to me about? Well, she started. No? Good then. Off you go. I smiled as if there was nothing wrong, as Aidan made his way out of the room and into the lounge. Everything all right? Denise asked. Yes, I lied. She glanced at the newspapers but didn't say anything more. I'll leave you to your reading then. The pointed look she gave me as she left the kitchen made me think that what she had really come to the house to do was deliver the bad news that my husband was not all he seemed. Or rather to spy on us as a family, to see if Jake was acting suspiciously since the news broke of his friendship with a student on Facebook. As soon as the door was closed, I began reading. And I didn't stop reading until I heard Jake's key in the door. During that time, I read about all the supposed things that had happened to my son, things they didn't even know for certain. He'd been taken as a sex slave by a sadistic paedophile and chained up in some sort of dungeon while I was out gadding about with a glass of Chardonnay in my hand. There was even a photograph of Jake and me on our honeymoon with fat grins on our faces. Then there were photographs of Rob, who had been branded a thug by some local source. Jake was portrayed as the sketchy teacher with a dark past who disappeared from his last school under a cloud of suspicion. They hinted at illicit affairs with underage schoolgirls. The papers were careful not to accuse, but they knew what they were doing. They knew what they were suggesting. If my husband could stick his dick in a teenage girl, what else was he capable of? And my judgment was awful. I was pregnant again, remember? With a man whom they all consider some sort of sick pedo without any evidence to back it up, along with the fact my first boyfriend was apparently a thug, and I was out partying all the time anyway because I was young. I slammed the papers shut as soon as I heard the door open. Anyone home? It's quiet in here. Oh, hello, Aidan. Denise? You can turn the sound up, you know. Gone, that's it. Where's your mum? Don't worry, I'll find her. Jake gave me a limp wave as he stepped into the kitchen and set his briefcase on the table. Sam Sutton finally handed in that homework I was telling you about. A week late, and he expects me to mark it. It's ridiculous. I might go to the head. What's going on? Are you... Jake glanced down at the papers spread out on the table. Ah... Ah, is that all you have to say? I demanded. I opened and closed my fists by my side. I told you that you needed to read them, he said, chastising me like a child. You need to know what's going on. You need to see the lies they're spreading. There was a sound of a throat being cleared, and Denise appeared in the doorway with her coat in her arms. I'm going to head off for the day. Call me if you need anything. My heart was pumping as I watched Denise leave the kitchen. I was waiting for that door to close so I could direct my attention back to Jake. Lies like this! I held up a picture of my husband with his arm around a teenage girl. That's not a lie, Jake. That's an actual picture of you fondling some girl. Fondling? Are you mad, woman? It was the end of a school year. She wanted a picture of us together before she left to do her A-levels at college. They're finding malice where there is none. And quite honestly, I thought my fucking wife would be on my side. The sound of his raised voice caused a jolt of anxiety to spread up my spine. Perhaps it was because he was always so soft-spoken, but it was frightening to hear the ferocity in his voice. I felt sick. Jake, reading those things was a shock. Why didn't you warn me? I tried... But you were so stuck in your little bubble with Aidan. You're so naive, Emma. And you think you would have learned after everything that happened the first time. They called you a slut. They branded you a little whore for getting pregnant when you were 18. It wasn't that bad, I pointed out. They made out like I was a bad mother for being so young. And I had hated them for it, but I never remembered them calling me anything derogatory like a slut. Was Jake making it up? Did he read more into the papers than what I remembered? I wasn't sure. No, 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 you're remembering it all wrong. They made you into a little whore, and it wasn't right. You were a good girl at school. It wasn't right. Jake paced up and down the kitchen, beads of sweat gathering just above his brow, even though it was a particularly chilly day. Why was he so warm? He'd already taken his boots and coat off. Jake, have you been drinking? He spun to face me, wobbling slightly and clutching the top of the chair as he moved. No? Don't lie to me! Ugh, I had one on the way home from school. I shook my head. A few more than one, I think. Maybe you should go to bed and sleep it off. We'll talk about this in the morning. But Jake wasn't listening anymore. He was pulling old bottles of whiskey from the kitchen cupboards. Most hadn't even been opened. They were neglected Christmas presents, the kind you allowed to gather dust at the back of an old liquor cabinet. I never laid a finger on that girl. Not in that way, anyway. The newspapers, they twist things. They make them dirty. You know what I mean? I was congratulating her, that's all. Jake, I said with a warning in my voice. I don't think the whiskey is going to help anything, is it? Sit down and I'll make you some coffee. Not a chance, you're the pregnant one. You sit down and I'll do it. He banged the cupboard door shut. I'm the man of the house. I'm the one who helps his wife. Need to look after my pregnant wife carrying my child. You don't sound well. You sound stressed out and drunk. Sit down, just for a minute. Then you can give me a foot rub. How does that sound? I tried to coax him into a chair, but just as I thought it had worked, he stood up again and began pacing the length of the kitchen. I provide for you, don't I? I had this kitchen built especially. I bought the house for you, you know, because I imagined what it would be like to live here and raise our kids. It was always for you. I know, I know. I put my head in my hands. This wasn't supposed to happen. Not now. My rock had cracked. He'd been busted open like an egg. We were so close, so fucking close, and then... Don't say it, I begged. Don't tell me you resent my child. If you say it now, you can never unsay it. I raised my head and our eyes locked. He didn't need to say the words because they were written all over his face. He was ashen with clammy skin and a red flush working its way up from his shirt collar. His hands were clenched by his side. His eyes were wide and wild. When he breathed, spittle flew from his clenched teeth. You hate him. You've hated him since we first brought him home. I said miserably, feeling a chill work its way up my arms and legs. Just shut up! I can't think. I need to think. He took off his glasses, pinched the bridge of his nose, and commenced pacing again. I need to think. What do you need to think about? I was on my feet, anger and frustration bubbling to the surface. He was supposed to be the man who had saved me. But there he was, with these secrets and this badly hidden animosity towards my own son. Here he was, and I couldn't stand the sight of him. He spun to face me. Don't you remember that day? I lifted a hand to cut him off. Of course I do. I don't want to talk about it, though. There were two knives. One you had stuck through the painting, and the other was slit in your wrist. Remember that? Remember how I found you in your mother's house? That was what you were before I saved you. I saved you. If it wasn't for me, you'd be dead. You wouldn't even be with Aiden right now. Chapter 20. My most shameful day had started with a glass of Pinot Grigio. Back then, I'd thought that if I drank wine, it wasn't like being an alcoholic. Vodka or whiskey was the drink of choice for alcoholics, not wine. Not white wine. That was civilised. You don't put a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc in a brown paper bag and sit in the park. I was at home on my own. My parents had been dead 6 months. I sat on the floor in the living room of Mum and Dad's cottage with a smorgasbord of disgusting items littering the floor. Leftover cartons of Chinese food that had barely been touched, crusted over with congealed grease along the rim.